At this time, 4 p.m. on September 8, 2015, I call our City Council work session to order to hear four presentations and discussions. They are as follows. Number one, presentations regarding business licenses and building inspections. Number two, inspections 101, the legal requirement, roles and responsibilities of the inspection team, what the inspector does in reviewing the construction of a home. Number three, business license 101, requirements, roles, and responsibilities of the business license team. And number four, municipal liabilities in the areas of inspection and business licensing, a legal perspective. Mr. Clement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor, and through you to the members of our City Council. The purpose of this workshop this afternoon is educational in nature, not only to better understand what our legal roles and responsibilities are in the areas of inspections and business licensing, or what we must do, but whether there are optional best practices that other communities have employed for the benefit of our citizens that we should consider. We have a panel of experts at both the national and state level who bring an objective perspective and years of experience. Sometimes it's productive to look outside of our city to see if our practices can be improved. We appear today not in a defensive role, but in an objective one, as we continue to try to improve the services that we provide. We are also here to clarify what it is that we do provide to help clarify some recent statements that have led to confusion. Our panel today includes the following. Our first speaker is Mr. John England, who has been involved in the construction industry for over 40 years. Mr. England holds over 30 International Code Council certifications and is a master code official, of which there are less than 800 worldwide. John started England Enterprises doing residential and commercial code inspections and plan reviews. Most notable contracts were the code inspections of public schools and state buildings in South Carolina, as well as running acting as building official for many jurisdictions in South Carolina and Tennessee. England Training LLC was started in 1996 and now trains over 3,000 contractors, architects, engineers, and code officials in the United States and the Caribbean in any given year. Mr. England also acts as an expert witness in local, state, and federal courts. Mr. England also is certified to teach building inspectors, fire marshals, architects, engineers, contractors, and home inspectors for the following jurisdictions and organizations, and offers continuing education credits for each: the state of South Carolina, the state of Georgia, the state of Tennessee, the state of Florida, the state of Louisiana, the state of Virginia, and the state of Ohio. Our second speaker is Mr. Scott Slatton. Scott is a native of Greenville County. He has had a diverse career, holds both a bachelor's and a master's in public administration, actually served as a city manager for a period of time. He then joined the Municipal Association of South Carolina in 2008 as a field services manager. And in 2013, he began work for the association as its legislative and public policy advocate, where he is tasked with exploring, developing, and advocating for solutions to the long-term chronic issues facing cities and towns across the state. Scott holds the credentialed manager designation, which is the highest possible designation from the International City and County Management Association, and he is co-chairman of the ICMA's Governmental Affairs and Policy Committee. He is also a member of the South Carolina City and County Management Association. Scott is the Municipal Association's staff contact for South Carolina Business Licensing Officials Association, As such, he is well-versed in South Carolina business licensing history, legislation affecting business licensing, and statewide business licensing policies and ordinance. He also helps plan and organize and run the annual Business License Officers Association meeting in the fall and their educational academy each spring. And last, we have attorney James Meggs, who's with us this afternoon. Mr. Meggs has an extensive career practicing municipal law in the public sector, including 17 years as the city attorney for the city of Columbia. During that time, Mr. Meggs represented Columbia and its officials in a wide array of cases, including tort liability, eminent domain, construction disputes, intergovernmental relations, land use planning, and zoning. He was trial counsel in a prominent federal antitrust case that found its way to the United States Supreme Court in 1991 and effectively ended the threat to local governments for money damage liability under federal antitrust law. He prepared and argued more than 25 cases in the appellate courts of South Carolina and in the Circuit Court of Appeals. He also served as an adjunct professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, teaching land use regulation and local government. He was elected to two terms as the president of the South Carolina Municipal Lawyers Association, chaired the government law section of the South Carolina Bar, and served for a number of years as the South Carolina state chair of the International Municipal Lawyers Association. He graduated from the Citadel in 1974 and received his Juris Doctor and Master's of Public Administration from the University of South Carolina. His practice presently concentrates on litigation, zoning, and land use planning, local government, and assisting firm clients in navigating through the maze of governments at all levels. And he is admitted to practice before the United States Supreme Court, the United States Court of Appeals, 4th District, District Court of South Carolina, and other courts in that jurisdiction. So, Mr. Mayor, we have assembled three experts in a variety of areas, and we're here to listen to their three presentations. The first one reminding us all of our legal requirements, roles, and responsibilities in the areas of inspections by John England. Then we will hear from Scott discuss Business License 101, requirements, roles, and responsibilities of the business license team. And lastly, we'll hear from Jim Meggs, who will discuss municipal liabilities and the areas of inspection and business licensing. I just wanted to make a few more comments. Two of the three panelists do have additional commitments this evening. One needs to be in Florida this evening, and one needs to be back in Columbia. So I have promised them that their role in this meeting will end no later than 6 o'clock, and I publicly would like to thank each of you for your commitment to be with us this evening. And secondarily, any one of these general areas could foster discussions that last hours, and I want to make sure for the purposes of education that we get through all of the three presentations. So my request to the council is that we allow Mr. England, Mr. Slatton, and Mr. Meggs to make their initial presentation in its entirety. And then thereafter, we obviously will open it up for questions from this council, and then thereafter questions from the general public. If that is okay, Mr. Mayor.
Yes, sir.
Okay, without any further ado, then, I'd like to introduce Mr. England, who will talk about the inspections process.
Stand or sit or...
You're fine with your mic, so you're fine where you are. Okay. Very comfortable.
I got a little handout here. And I figured you always have good things in writing. Thank you for the introduction, City Manager. The little handout I gave you, I've kind of looked over the documentation with Mr. Smith, asked me to look over what y'all did in the city and the paperwork trail and the 9 yards. And like you said earlier, I've been teaching building inspectors in this state for about 18 years and seen a lot of, you know, things they've done wrong, good, bad, and different. So, I mean, without further ado, I mean, I think, I always say building inspectors are kind of like red-headed stepchildren. You know, everybody loves us until something goes wrong. Okay, and it's kind of a daunting task sometimes. And as much as I travel the country and involved in code changes and all of that, I mean, when you start looking at building codes, you're looking at like a set of encyclopedias that we can't memorize, but we try to know where everything's at. So on the front of the little handout, I kind of put a couple interesting ones on there. These are just copies of the current codes we're enforcing in this state. And if you notice the stack of books, there's that many reference standards that go for these codes. Yes, which we don't have copies of half the time. And, we, you know, between that and manufacturer specs and all, it just gets to be a daunting task at some days, okay? If you turn to the second page in there, I kind of put some, I left some note areas for y'all in there. And I think the biggest thing, and we've done this for years, what is the intent of the building code more than anything? And the intent of the building code is life safety. I mean, we all know that as we do inspections and we go out on our daily duties, that, you know, time is money, and I mean, it all relates to one another. And as most building departments are supposed to be self-sufficient, not being their bear on the taxpayers, you know, all the fees that they collect are supposed to run the departments. And I mean, certain state laws actually say that, okay, in certain states they do. And the intent is to publish established minimum requirements for homes. I mean, I've made jokes before with building inspectors and contractors that, you know, the contractors want to build the worst house you can build legally some days. You know, and it's kind of a funny joke, but, I mean, it's the minimum code. I mean, we can always build better houses, and when you start looking at history from going back to, like, Hurricane Andrew, and I was down there after that, when you start seeing four nails in a sheet of plywood that was holding on a roof, we've come a long way. I mean, not everything that we do is perfect these days, but, you know, we keep moving forward. Education is the key here. I mean, right now in this state's a lot further ahead in the state of Georgia with inspectors because we are requiring licensing for inspectors in this state. The state of Georgia don't require inspectors to be licensed or certified. We require 24 hours continuing education per inspector per every 2 years. I think there ought to be more than that, but that's just my train of thought. I looked at the ordinances that y'all have. Y'all adopted Chapter 1. That was a key thing for me because that gets the intent of the code and the jurisdiction. I mean, that's one of the first things I asked from the department. Considering the size of the city of Aiken, I mean, we have basically three and maybe another part-time inspector. That's about average for this size town. Unlike some other towns where you might have part-time inspectors, or I actually had a class last week and we had three people from Portland, Oregon in there, and I said, how big is y'all's inspection department? Well, there's about 300 people.
It's Oregon.
So, I mean, you know, so you go from one extreme to the other, you know what I mean? And the bigger the town, the more problems they show up. The smaller the town, the more responsibilities one or two people have to take on. I mean, it's kind of like being the jack of all trades, master of none, something. Okay? I looked at the permit fees, and I've actually put back on one of the other pages back there about toward the end some other paperwork to back this up. And the permit fees in the city of Aiken are around the norm in this part of the state. I still think they're behind times. I mean, because it's like this. I mean, houses are getting more complicated. We're needing to spend more time on paperwork and everything else that goes with this. And the only way you can do this is to increase time on the job, which increases permit fees, which you've got to pay for it. So that's just a recommendation back there. The permit applications I looked at on the that are currently with the city, I made a couple recommendations to change a few things here because I thought it's just me. I've been around so many jurisdictions, I see little holes there can be filled and all of that. So that's one of the things that I did. Okay. As far as plan review is on the very next page, The city of Aiken does better on plan reviews than many cities. A lot of towns don't do residential plan reviews. We do in the city of Aiken. Plan review is a process, and it's kind of an interesting process when you start looking at what all we do want and what all we do get. We'd like to have more than plan reviews than we usually get, especially when it comes to residential. I mean, it was kind of funny, we were talking about building for this council earlier, and the home builders even made a thing that we're not even supposed to get trust drawings during the plan review process. We have to wait until we get on the job site and hope they're right at that point. So, I mean, you know, there's a when we push one way, guess who pushes back at us? The home builders push back at us sometimes because they're wanting to get the jobs done and going. And, you know, on plan reviews, we would love to have tons of information. We don't get it. You get a set of plans that are basic usually at the most. You get a little bit of electrical, but a little HVAC, but you don't get a lot of stuff. I know the state starting to require to get energy plans now. I mean, to me, energy is a big deal, and that's the big buzzword these days, but of course, I'd much rather see a lot of other stuff on these plans some days. Basically, plan review process is to try to head off potential code violations in the field. We don't want to hold up construction projects. If we head them off before we get there, then guess what? The contractors keep moving. They don't come calling to y'all and making a whole bunch of spill that we're holding them up. Because that's one of them back and forth things to do. I did wrote a code section down in the bottom of that page that said approval of construction documents. And if you notice what we have actually adopted in Chapter 1, it says reviewed for code compliance. That doesn't mean that everything is approved for code compliance. We just reviewed it because you would have to have a staff of 10 people to take a residential set of plans and go through them with a fine-tooth comb. And when you're trying to do 8 or 10 in one day, you know, time is, we're back to, you know, how long do we spend on these plans? You know what I mean? And residential plans tend to be a lot less lackluster than the commercial. Because commercials, you've got design professionals and architects and engineers and all of that there. So that's the plan review process. Okay. As far as inspections, on the next page. I guess to do a very good inspection, a very thorough inspection, you would have to be on the job 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Then your permit fees would be how much? Way out of the realm of everybody hollering. Right now, we're doing an average of 5 to 7 inspections per house. And when you got inspectors out there doing 8 or 10 houses a day, I mean, you figure they're there 1 hour at the most by the time you got drive times and all that. So it just gets to be that you can only do so much, and you look for what first? First thing I'm looking for is life safety. Can you get them out of the house? Is it safe? Is it structurally sound? And all of that. Because, I mean, I understand that a lot of times, I mean, the public looks at us kind of different sometimes. And I love storytelling, so you have to bear with my stories a little bit. I was sitting down in Venice, Florida 2 weeks ago at a little local pub. And this elderly gentleman, about 70 years old, was sitting next to me. And I said, and he found out what I did. And I says, so what do you think about building inspectors? Well, my daughter just built a new house, and they missed all this stuff. I said, what did they miss? Well, her upper cabinets in her kitchen, a 10-inch dinner plate won't fit in there. And I said, really? She said, yeah. I said, do you think that's a big concern of ours? Well, it should be, because dinner plates are 10 inches. And I said, well, I don't really care if they put cabinets up there or not, because we're trying to get the minimum intent of the code. We're trying to get the life safety portion of this out there, trying to make sure everything's safe and secure on these houses. So, I mean, the public's look at what building inspectors do sometimes is totally different. I mean, it's kind of interesting. Mayor, I challenge you to go ride with an inspector one day on the job site. I mean, it's kind of like a cat and mouse game. Can we find what the contractors are missing? Because it's kind of interesting. I mean, the more knowledge you have, the more you know where to look. I mean, I was an old electrician by trade, and I remember inspectors coming to my job site. I knew what they were looking for, and I made sure they had that, because, I mean, everybody out there, you know, misses something or does something else. Okay? Right now, we do foundation inspection, slab's not in there, but according to the types of inspection required here, plumbing, mechanical, gas, electrical, rust, floodplain management, FEMA sticking us, we're getting a lot more federal regulations shoved down our throat. These things, the building departments are, if you don't know much about this, FEMA's a big deal with these things. The energy could come down because the state took some money, and that was something that got put on the building inspector's department. When you come to commercial, you've got ADA requirements, so there's a lot of other stuff here than just a building sometimes. And we've got to look at all the liability issues that I'm sure Mr. Mayville here will talk about. Right of entry is a big deal for inspectors. People think, well, you know, I've heard this story more than once. Well, if you get a building permit, the inspector should just stop by. There have been more lawsuits of that than you can shake a stick at. It's called trespassing. Because unless the guy called for an inspection, technically you don't have a right to be on the job. Which is kind of strange, but I mean, you know, it's kind of like, but you've got to call for an inspection. Some of the verbiage I put in for the application would cure some of that, Gary, if you look at that. I mean, you know, but I mean, it's just a whole bunch of stuff here. The other thing that we worry about in inspections is you got like an existing house. I go up the front door, knock, and here comes a little kid, 12 years old, at the front door. I come inspect your addition. But first thing I'm going to tell you, I ain't going through that front door if that's the only person in that house. Or if there's a single lady in that house, I ain't going through that front door. Because you're going to open yourself up to what? Can of worms there when it starts. Okay, so. I mean, so inspections are kind of, you know, you want to do them, people want more of them, but of course we have to do watch our, where we go and what we do from these things, okay? On the very next page, there's certificate of occupancy. Every building should have one. I pulled out of chapter 110, out of section 110.3, what should be on here. One interesting thing with chapter 1, just for council's notice, chapter 1 is not adopted by the state. We have to adopt it separately. So anything in chapter 1, we want to add, delete, change, we can do. We were talking about that earlier. We, you know, a lot of jurisdictions only got chapter 1. Chapter 1 is our administrative chapter. We put anything in there or take anything out. You take people like the city of Columbia or the city of Charleston, they'll add other stuff in there or take stuff out with floodplain or other stuff. So that's something that you have a viable option to do. You can add or change or do whatever you want to. So that was the first thing I wanted to see was your ordinance to see if you had adopted it separately from the code. Because, I mean, it needed to be adopted separately, and it was. Owner-builders are another story. I think that's a big issue here sometimes. And I'll just give you a good example of how owner-builders and contractors sometimes treat us. You get somebody coming and they're either going to build a deck in their backyard or whatever. They come in, they pull a permit for the deck, we get a set of plans for the deck, and they say, when are you going to build the deck? We're going to build it next week. That's correct. 3 years down the road, we go look in the permit drawer, and guess what? Permit's still open. We never did an inspection. The deck. And this happens all the time, because guess what people won't call for? They're not getting power turned on, they're not getting water turned on, so we don't get deck inspections. That's been an issue for years. And it's just not here. I was talking to a building official from Mount Pleasant when times got lean. He said he was going through his files, cleaning up the old permits and trying to close them out and be done something. So there's ways you can do that through the computer systems and stuff like that. If they don't happen, then somebody needs to go out and check these decks and stuff like that. But what's going to happen one day is some deck's going to fail. And, of course, well, they got a permit, but we didn't ever do an inspection. So that, to me, that's an issue. But, needs to be dealt with. Okay, so that's one of the things. And owner builders are the worst ones. Because there is no license here, there's nothing else here, and that's one of the big things. The next couple pages in here, this is some other things that I've put in here. The next page in here was the evaluation of what the city they can charge you for building permits. The appendices at the bottom of the page is what ICC recommends you charge for permits. Now, one of the big problems we have here is, and I don't want to, I'll all say it, contractors don't like it. Yeah. I've had contractors, and I've had other people come in, give you a good example. Church comes in, wants to put an addition on the church. Well, how much is the addition? But it's only 5,000 long. What's a 5,000 square foot addition? Well, all the labor's free. Well, that's beside the point. We still got to do the work. We still got to do this work. Am I correct? So to kind of just as a check and balance sometimes, and on the very next two pages is an item published by International Code Council, which tells us how much they consider housing to be costing. It's usually a low ball figure because they're taking a national average here. I'm not going to try to figure out what housing costs are. I mean, you know and I know, if I go out and build the starter home, it's going to cost me less per square foot than if I go build a luxury house. You know that. So this is kind of a roundabout, just generalized, something we can check and balance the fees. And on the back side of that, I actually put a big yellow thing there that talked about right now, and I pulled this up this morning, they think the average house costs about $112 a square foot deal. That doesn't count land value, that doesn't count anything else. And of course, you know, that all comes with a big grain of salt, because if you're building a starter home, that's one thing, but if you build a luxury house, it can be $130, $200. But this is just a kind of a check and balance a lot of times we can go by to make sure people are giving us a fair shot at, you know, our fees. That's what this is about, okay? Next couple pages is just basically some information I put on here. One of the things that we find, especially in several lawsuits I've been involved in, is the application is the most important piece of paperwork we have, more so than anything else, because if people tell us the wrong story in the application, the rest of it goes by the wayside pretty much. A lot of jurisdictions now are getting applications notarized. Get the clerk in the office to get it notarized, get the owner to sign it as well as the contractor to sign it. That way we know we've got two signatures on it. Everybody knows what's going on. Either that or get the contractor to have a copy of the contract with them. I mean, I listen to some of the stuff about, I know people sell property and then they build a house, and you know, by the time it gets to the building department, really the owner of the property has changed, and it's hard to track this sometimes. So that's one of the things on the next two pages. The next page is something that I kind of drew up for one of the classes we did. Building departments, and if you go right to the Building Official Association and mention the word owner-builder, that's always an issue with us. People think they can build houses. I can go get a program and look at the computer and say, well, I know how to build a house. And there's a whole other story out there. And, I mean, I'm not going to tell you how many times I've had people come to me and say, John, what a contractor took me for a ride. That's what I thought you were the contractor. And what they did was they went and got an unlicensed contractor that's not licensed by the state or somebody and build a house. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. So this little form that we've kind of come up with on the next couple of pages, and I'm not going to say it's perfect, but it's a recommendation that we make homeowners sign to at least give, let them know their rights and know their obligations. It's kind of interesting when you start talking to a builder or somebody. If you haven't been by the building department, there's a poster in the building department. I was glad he put the first one I've seen on so far. And it says building official quote. Big old poster, they frame it, put it up. We're giving it away to the building official conference. And some of the stories we hear. So you don't have a code book, Mr. Builder. I've heard that more than once. You know. Well, we've been doing it this way for 40 years. Okay, so I mean, but the quotes are kind of interesting. Okay. On the next page over here is, and I talked with the building official earlier about this, and this is something, when we run the city of Buford for several years, we had a couple home inspectors down there, and it was kind of funny. The city administrator had come to us and said, John, we got a complaint against the building department. I said, okay. What is it? Well, it's a 35-page report. I said, let me see the report. Okay, so I feed through the report, and out of 35 pages, I couldn't find one code violation. It was nail polish that covered a carpet, or there was a stain on carpet. Some home inspector was looking at this building and basically doing just a punch list to the building. Paint chips and this and that. And they, you know, I don't, as a building inspector, I don't care if the countertop's chipped. Is it going to kill anybody? No. Does it look bad? Yes. Should the contractor name the right? Yes. But I can't really write that up as a code violation. But remember, we're trying to make it light, this light safer. So we come up with this little form here, and it's got, it says Cool City Building Department at the top of it, and actually tells them that if they have problems against contractors, please go to the contractors, go to LLR, and put a claim against the contractor. That's the first thing you ought to do. The second thing is we ask them to fill this out front and back. We didn't want to call it a complaint form, we call it an investigation request. One of the things that was on the back of this page, which was real important to me, was basically, I want to know what code section of those you're talking about. My time's valuable. I've got thousands of jobs out there to do. I've got thousands of inspections to do. I don't need running, shouldn't be on a wild goose chase. So if you give me the code section, we'll look at it. Does an inspector make a mistake? Yeah. I ain't going to tell you how many code violations I found in this building when I walked in here today. It's an old building. Okay? Do you think I can go behind any one of your inspectors and find something in this? Yes, I can. You think you go behind me? Yeah. We all got a different perspective here. We look at things. Mr. Mayor, you go behind me, you'd find stuff you didn't like. Why you missed out? I don't know. I was in a hurry today or whatever, so things do get missed. Building inspectors do the best they can do. Unless you want to sit on the job 8 hours a day and watch every nail being pounded into every piece of roofing and siding and trim and the paint going on and all that. I mean, things get done. Things get covered up before you get there. The biggest fight the building departments have sometimes is somebody pour a concrete slab, and then we get out there and say, well, we didn't inspect it. What can we do now? Go find me an engineer. And hopefully we find an engineer that knows what they're talking about in this state. Because according to LLR, an engineer can practice in any field he feels comfortable with. They're not electrical engineers, mechanical, they're just engineers. I kind of make it kind of funny sometimes that they do everything except blow the whistle on the train. Okay? Because, and it bothers the building department sometimes, because I've gotten electrical plans before written by licensed engineers, and they're wrong. So, we're kind of like the traffic cops, if that makes sense. You're sitting out on a street corner, you're directing traffic all the time, and you spot the one with a tail light out, and you stop him. You think others went by and we missed a tail light? Yeah. Now, if the old jalopy comes down and is about to fall apart, we're going to stop it and make sure it gets off the road. Because it's a life safety to everybody else in the road. So if you kind of think about it like that, it makes a lot of sense. Okay? The last page here, and I will kind of go over this one. And I know this is about lawsuits and about some other stuff, and I've done a lot of lawsuits. I had my own private provider company for several years that contracted with many jurisdictions. Most by the way, I had 20 or 30 lawsuits because as a private company, I can get sued a lot easier than the jurisdiction can. And it's been everything from, we did the city of Atlantic Beach one time, and I remember when the police chief went and locked up the preacher for going in an unsafe building. Well, they sued us for discrimination. Okay, so it's from all kind of aspects. These two that I kind of put on here, I figured they were near and dear to here, Barnwell and Augusta. And I don't know, of course, Augusta's in a different state, so the laws are over there a little bit different. But I followed this from the beginning, and this is what happens sometimes when building departments get out of their sandbox and go into territory they shouldn't. I didn't want to write this whole synopsis here, so I kind of wrote a little thing here. Georgia Paquette Power at the time requested from Augusta, before they turn power back onto the building, then offer 6 months that they get a letter from the building department. So, Lewis Van, which worked for the city of Augusta, went out to inspect a mobile home pole that had been out many times before an inspection. Now, number one is the building department has no testers. They're lucky to have a screwdriver sometimes. And he's going out and take a visual look at this mobile home. Number one is we don't know what's behind the walls because it's 1960s mobile home. He looked at trailer pulls, he looked at connections, he takes the covers off, everything looks fine. It looked like it did last time. We got there 2 years ago. Nothing's changed. So he called. He writes four letters from the city. Turns out about it. Sounds good. Back to the newlyweds moved in there, and the trailer burned down and killed all of us. Reading between the lines and all that, come to find out it was some light that somebody had put together with some tape instead of a wire nut in the ceiling somewhere over the last 40 years. We don't know where it was. Fire marshal come out and said it was electrical fire. So, of course, the parents of the kids decide to sue, not the county, the building inspector. So we have this level of protection. If we do our job to the best of our ability, to our standards, then we should have some kind of protection against lawsuits. It went all the way to the Georgia Supreme Court. Reading some of the judges' decisions along the way, they didn't want to say yes or no. It didn't. They didn't say that the building inspector was wrong, but they didn't want to put themselves in that thing for the. At the end, the county, city and county of West Columbia County, the city of Augusta, decided to go ahead and pay for the lawsuit to be done with it and not hear the verdict. They didn't want to go to a jury trial. So I asked the building department, I says, I have a question for you. I said, yeah. I said, why are you all writing these letters? Georgia Power wants it. And why does Georgia Power want it? Get liability off of who? Georgia Power. I said, why are y'all doing that? He said, that's a contractual issue between Georgia Power and that homeowner. We did not, was not in our city ordinance. That was nothing else. We're not going to inspect these things. We're not getting paid for it. We're not getting anything else. It was a service put out by the city to keep Georgia Power happy. A lot of other jurisdictions take the thing that we still write the letters, but we want a licensed electrician to go out and look at these projects way beforehand and certify them before we put our name on the letter to do what? Make sure, because they got the tools, they got a lot of other stuff we don't have in the building department. Okay. That was one of them. The other one, and I actually got this last week, was Green versus Feller in England Enterprises, City of Barnwell, Ron Powell, and about six more people there. And basically, we run the City of Barnwell for many years. And Mr. Felder hired, Felder built a building for Green. So Mr. Green hired Mr. Felder, a contractor, to build the building. Barnwell hired England Enterprises and Ron Powell, an employee to act as the building official. They contracted this out. Okay. Felder fired Green and finished the work himself. We never issued a CO on the building because the building never got finished. Felder found some issues with the property. There were code issues. There were code issues. There were all kind of other little things. Were they major code issues? No, they were minor. More of it was about he didn't like some of the work. He didn't like the cabinets. He didn't like other things. Felder sued Green and others. We asked for summary judgment in the thing to be dismissed out of the case. And I kind of put this, and I sent it to Mr. Smith also. I sent it to him last week when I got it back. And on the back of this thing, it talks about the summary, the proposed order. It was filed. We got the order. And this is Court of Common Pleas. And it basically says, at before the end of the thing, the purpose of the building code is to protect the public at large, not to create a legal duty flowing from the building official to each and every resident who can establish that a building code violation or violations were undetected. And to me, that's a big deal. Now remember, I was a third party. I was not a city employee. And my liability opens up a whole bunch more. So for a judge here in this state to give me this, wants me to get kind of get back in the inspection business, which I'm out, which I sold several years ago. But I'm not going to do it. So. And I'll leave that as part of my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. England. I'm sure we'll return in a little bit for a series of questions. Next, we have Mr. Slatton, who will be addressing the whole issue of business licensing. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Clem, Mayor, Council. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I look forward to making these remarks about business licensing here in South Carolina, and I look forward to your questions at the end of our call. Before I start, I'm going to preface my remarks by saying that I'm not going to make any particular judgments or evaluations on the City of Aiken's business licensing process. as I am not familiar with it to the extent that your staff is, and probably you all are. But what I will tell you about your staff is that you do have a professional staff that has a very, very good reputation among the other municipalities across the state. You have a former president of the South Carolina Business Licensing Officials Association, and you also have a staff member who is extremely active in the association. And I will tell you that your staff regularly participates in our training that we hold twice a year through the Business Licensing Officials Association, and then they also participate in quarterly training sessions that are held here in your region. So what I will be talking about is based on the Municipal Association's Model Business License Ordinance, its application across the state for those cities and towns that have chosen to adopt it in part or in whole. And I will talk to you a little bit about some of the best practices that we're aware of with regard to business licensing in the state. And I'll also say that I do know that your business license ordinance, for the most part, is reflective of the model business license ordinance that the Municipal Association has created and maintained for many, many years. So, Stuart, we'll go ahead and start. You can just put all those bullets up there at once if you like. What I want to talk to you about first is, and make sure you understand first, is what is a business license tax? It's an excise tax on the activity of doing business inside a municipality. The business license tax is calculated on a business's gross income. It is not calculated on a business's net income, because that would then make it an income tax, which is not permissible for municipalities under state law. And it's calculated on gross income tax, gross tax, in an effort to ensure that the tax is applied equally no matter how successful a business is or is not. How you manage a business is irrelevant to the business license tax. The business license tax is also a method for helping for businesses to help support a municipal government's provision of services to businesses. People say, well, we pay property taxes. Well, not all businesses necessarily pay property taxes. They may through rent, they may through direct ownership, but oftentimes the businesses, many businesses require service provisions that that are above and beyond what those property taxes may provide to the city. The business license tax is one of the three largest revenue sources for most every municipality across the state of South Carolina. And I would dare say that if you have to ask your finance director, she'll confirm that is true for the city of Aiken. The business license tax has become much more important to cities and towns across the state since particularly 2006, when your hands were tied by the General Assembly with the passage of Act 388, which severely restricts your ability to raise property tax revenues sufficient to provide services to your citizens, services that the citizens request. The business license tax is the only general fund revenue source that is completely controlled by you as the city council. For now, as you all probably remember, this past session, there was a bill that was introduced that would severely restrict your ability to raise revenues through your locally adopted business license tax. Currently, you as the city council members have direct and total control over the rates and the application of your business license ordinance around the city. And then, of course, the business license tax is authorized to be levied by cities and towns through Section 5730 in the Code of Laws. Title 5, of course, is the municipal title, and then Chapter 7 is a general provisions section or general provisions chapter in the statute. You can go to the next slide, Stuart. Let's talk about what a business license tax is not. A business license tax is not a warranty on a business's work. It is not a vetting of a business's credentials, except in the case of contractors. And even there, there is a very specific language that's in the model business license ordinance, which is also contained in your ordinance, I have seen, where a contractor is only required to show evidence of his or her qualifications or his or her trade licenses. Those would be credentials that are issued by the Department of Labor Licensing Regulation. Don would like to see, I'm sure, when he would be professional, he probably would want to see the credentials for contractors. Some cities and towns across the state may use their business license ordinance to require additional vetting or additional production of credentials from a particular business, but that is not commonplace. A city's ability to require more credentials or evidence of qualifications from a contractor or any business for that matter is certainly limited by the resources that are available to them, particularly through staffing. And it's also limited by policy decisions that you as city councils make across the state as to how business friendly or not you want to be. So that's an important part of the business license, of what the business license tax is not. Similarly, the business license tax is not a consumer protection measure. It is a revenue generator for you. It is not meant, and has historically not been meant, to provide the consumer with certain protections. Now, in the course of issuing business licenses, they are certainly, in most every city and town across the state, tied to the issuance of building permits, tied to the approval of zoning requests or zoning checking off to make sure the zoning is proper, but they don't have to be. The business license tax is not necessarily, its issuance isn't dependent on those things in the business license ordinance, except unless the local jurisdiction has chosen to use it that way. The business license tax, as I said earlier, is not a tax on profits because it is calculated on gross income. There are discrepancies across the state, unfortunately, as to what gross income is, but that's something that we at the Municipal Association are working with legislators and working internally to try and come up with so that we can have some standardization across the state. Let's go to the next slide. What is the basis for the business license tax? It was established, actually, in 1872 by the General Assembly. It was taken out a couple of months out of the law, but that was before it first appeared. But it was specifically mentioned as being authorized in the state constitution that we are still operating under, that was adopted in 1895, the Tillman Constitution, if you will. And if you haven't seen it, on our website is this great law review article that was written back in the 80s, I believe, by William Quirk, who is a law professor at the University of South Carolina. It's entitled Nature of a Business License Tax. You can find it on our website. And it is a great history and chronology of the business license tax in South Carolina. Businesses, when they come in and are asked to pay their business license tax, they are classified based upon their profitability according to the Internal Revenue Service. Every business in the country is assigned a NAICS code. NAICS stands for the North American Industrial Classification System. Everybody has a NAICS code. I can't remember how many digits it is. But everybody is assigned based on their grouping and likeness to other similar businesses in the United States. And as the economy ebbs and flows, as businesses become more profitable or not, their NAICS code classification changes, and then as those move around with their NAICS codes, they also move up and down within the Model Business License Ordinance's rate index. You're assigned a NAICS code, and then based on your profitability, you are classified into a rate classification within your models, within your ordinance, and within the model ordinance. And businesses move in and out of more or less profitable rate classes depending on their change, their change of profitability according to the IRS. The business license tax in South Carolina is largely based upon the Municipal Association's model business license ordinance, as I mentioned. It is a part of a comprehensive handbook that we write and maintain. It's in our business license handbook, which you can find on our website as well. Let me go back real quick up here to where we're talking about the classification of the businesses on the profitability index. It is imperative that city councils across the state stay fairly current with the IRS profitability indices. A city council that doesn't adjust businesses based on the updated IRS classifications can leave themselves open to some liability, and I'm sure Mr. Mayes will talk about this more in depth than I can. But if a doctor is still classified in a rate class from 20 years ago when he or she was probably a more profitable business than he or she is today, then that creates a problem for you as city council. You need to make sure that you maintain those rate classes and keep them up to date. And that's something that we help you do as the Municipal Association has taken upon itself to ensure that our model is updated periodically. Think about the fax machine manufacturer. The fax machine manufacturer probably isn't as profitable today as he was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So he should not be kept in the same rate class that he was when he was more profitable. Throughout the history of the business license tax in South Carolina, it has been attacked on numerous occasions, and in each case it has prevailed. There are certainly challenges to the business license tax, to the business license ordinance, that will come to us again in the future, but by ensuring that it is applied fairly and based on these profitability indices, we hope that we can prevail going forward. Next slide. Talk about the roles and responsibilities of a city and its different actors with regard to the business license tax. Just like with any policy, council, you know that it is your responsibility to adopt the business license ordinance and the policies that you see fit for its enforcement. And those can be as varied as the cities and towns that exist across the state. Depending on how rigorously you want to enforce your business license ordinance, it will determine how much you put toward staff resources or not in your business license program. You set the rates, and then you periodically update those as the IRS profitability index changes. Of course, as I said, we at the Municipal Association are responsible taking it on the responsibility on ourselves to maintain this on your behalf so that when it comes time for the rate classes to be updated or the next code changes to be made, then you can do that very easily with an amendment to your business license ordinance. The staff's responsibility, just like any other policy that you set forth or an ordinance that you adopt, the staff's job is to enforce that ordinance and to execute those policies. And again, those are limited already, as you know, by your resources. The staff responsible for informing the council of how well the ordinance is going, how well the policies are working, and then they're responsible for recommending changes to you based on the information that they gather. One role and responsibility that I have put on here that I left off and I shouldn't have is the public's responsibility. Obviously, that's one of the reasons we're all here today, is to the public's responsibility is to let you know how it thinks things are going or not, and you make decisions based upon that. Best practices and training. As I've already mentioned, the model business license ordinance, it was last updated in 2012, 2013. And as I showed you, here's the business license handbook. This is the go-to guide for business license officials across the state of South Carolina, whether or not they have adopted in part or in whole the model business license ordinance. We constantly pore over this document and change it and massage it as needed, whether it's prompted by changes at the IRS, changes in the General Assembly. We have the standardized business license application, and the city of Aiken is one of 72 cities and towns across the state that have agreed to accept the standardized business license application. It was developed by the Business Licensing Officials Association several years ago, and it is a form that transient businesses can fill out their business information, make multiple copies of it, and then submit it to those cities and towns across the state that agree to accept it, rather than having to fill out a different business license application for all 270 cities and towns across the state. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the Business Licensing Officials Association, it has a rigorous training institute and advanced academy that are held once in the spring and once in the fall. And then there are two credentials that are issued by the Business Licensing Officials Association, the Master in Business Licensing and the Accreditation in Business Licensing. The ABL is a credential that is issued to a business license official who has completed the Business Licensing Official Association's training institute. That is a 3-year training institute, and then they're required to take a comprehensive exam they must pass before they are able to earn the ABL. The Master in Business Licensing, the MBL, is an advanced accreditation that shows and that demonstrates a business licensing official's dedication to ongoing training and advancement. Those are the best practices that we promulgate across the state, and we encourage 8 regional groups, they're called our little COG groups, that meet quarterly to discuss common issues and best practices in their particular area. They usually meet for, have a lunchtime meeting, and their training is valid towards use in earning the master business license. The last slide, of course, is a list of resources. You can go directly to the Code of Law on the State House's website, Title 5, Chapter 7. There is a very simple sentence in Section 5730 that says a municipality may levy a business license tax on the gross income of a business. And that's it. Everything else has been developed by the Municipal Association and by our member cities and towns over the years. Of course, our website, masc.sc, you'll just type in the keyword business licensing in the search box. You'll find more information than you probably care to find. And then, of course, you can always go to the VLOA's website and take a look at the professionals, the list of professionals there, and some of the projects that they're working on. With that, that concluded my slides, and I look forward to your questions later on.
Thank you very much, Scott. And lastly, Mr. Mayor, we have Mr. Jim Meggs, who will address the issue of municipal liability in the areas of inspections and business licensing. Sir.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me. We've enjoyed the prior comments, and to the extent I concur with some of the statements made by these gentlemen, I'll try to identify those as I go through this bit of an exercise. I'm embarrassed to admit that my municipal service has been so extensive and long, maybe not so extensive, but long, as I was a municipal attorney when we had sovereign immunity in this state, with two exceptions. We had motor vehicle accident liability, only to the extent of the statutory minimums for property damage and personal injury, that being $5,000 for property damage, $15,000 for personal injury, and $30,000 in the event of a death. And we had another limited area of liability for street defects, which had a number of trips and traps for the unwary and very low limits of liability. All that changed in 1986. But before that time, two things are significant in our discussion this evening. Before that time, employees could be personally liable in certain circumstances. There was also a rule that's been alluded to here this evening, and that is the public duty rule. And the public duty rule is what this discussion is going to turn on largely this evening, because the public duty rule existed prior to the abrogation of sovereign immunity by the court and by the legislature, and it is still the law in South Carolina, having been embraced in recent cases as a survivor to the Supreme Court's invitation to the legislature to reform the liability blueprint in South Carolina for state and local government in 1986. So, again, the important factors, I think, are the public duty rule that we're going to talk about this evening pre-existed the abrogation of sovereign immunity. It survived the enactment of the South Carolina Tort Claims Act and is the law in South Carolina today, and I think we'll find that to be very important and significant in analyzing the city's exposure to liability in this business licensing and, more importantly, perhaps, building inspection process. Well, in 1986, the legislature passed the South Carolina Tort Claims Act because basically the court had told them the year prior that if you don't act, the whole thing's going out the window. There won't be any sovereign immunity. There won't be any caps on liability. And so, as I argued in one of my cases in the Supreme Court, so the legislature accepted your invitation to court and adopted this comprehensive rewrite of the liability blueprint. In the act, the legislature declared it to be the public policy of the state to recognize immunity, to construe the act in favor of the immunity of the government, with certain exceptions, and there are now, I lost count, there are probably over 45 enumerated exceptions to the waiver of liability in the act. Now, that's real confusing because on the one hand, you say liability is the rule and immunity is the exception, but the legislature has said it both ways in this statute, and I won't try to belabor that. It even confuses me still. But we kind of meet ourselves coming and going in the same direction. In the act, they've carved out, the legislature has carved out the continued immunity for certain governmental functions, including inspections, licensing, and this type of activity. What they didn't touch was the public duty rule. And so let me try to hone in on that. One important comment to note, the legislature immunizes employees, generally speaking. So after the adoption of the Tort Claims Act, your building officials, your license inspectors, don't need to fear personal liability except with two exceptions under state law. That is, if they go out and with the intent to harm someone and cause injury. So if your inspector gets into a fisticuffs with a contractor and he started it, then he's probably got a personal problem. The city's not responsible for that, not liable for that bad act by your employee. The employee singly is responsible for that. If the employee acts outside of the proper scope of his or her duties, then that can give rise to personal liability for the employee. But under the Tort Claims Act in South Carolina, employees generally are immune otherwise in tort, and they need not fear for their personal pocketbook. Okay, so back to our public duty rule. John brought right to the fore the intent statement in the building code. And this is real important because it clearly states a broad public duty statement rather than giving providing language that could give rise to lawsuits by folks whose houses turn up with defects or commercial buildings, what have you. This is totally important, and I'm going to illustrate that in a minute. Hopefully, but if the purpose of this code is to establish minimum requirements to safeguard the public safety, health, and general welfare, etc., that's a quintessential statement of purpose that will dovetail into the public duty rule. If the duty is a public duty, it is not something that is actionable by someone who claims injury. The whole case falls for lack of duty. There can be no negligence or no claim of negligence or no lawsuit based on a negligence theory if there's no duty, because negligence presumes that there's a duty owed by the defendant to the plaintiff in some respect. There's been a breach of that duty, and damages have proximately resulted from the breach. If there's no duty, you don't even get to first base. All right. Now, let me try to highlight why this statement is so important in the context of tort liability. I mentioned the Tort Claims Act and its carve out of various reservations of sovereign immunity against the general waiver. Several of those exceptions might pertain to building inspections, maybe even business licensing. However, if that public duty factor is in the analysis, then even under the Tort Claims Act, you don't get to pursue a claim against the city or its employees. There's a case out there that people talk about a lot in this context. It's a case called Steinke, S-T-E-I-N-K-E. And I'm not going to bore you with the details about Steinke, but Steinke gave the tort lawyers a little ray of hope for a while and caused and continues to cause some consternation about these reservations of immunity in the Tort Claims Act. In one of those reservations, there's an exception for gross negligence. And the court has said you've got to read gross negligence into some or all of the rest of them. But you don't get there. You don't get to that gross negligence analysis if there's a public duty factor in the equation. Only if you get to beyond the public duty do you get there. Now, here's Steinke. We have folks who suffer injury, or their decedents suffered injury as a result of the Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation to inspect a cable and cage that was being used as a bungee jumping amusement ride at the beach. Folks died as a consequence of the failure of this equipment, and Steinke sued LLR. What was the first play LLR might have made? Well, the duty to inspect this apparatus is a public duty, and we don't have to go any further. Here's the contrast. I'm going to read to you the statute that provides the purpose for the regulation, for the statute that was to be complied with by South Carolina LLR. Here's how that statute reads. The purpose of this chapter is to guard against personal injuries and the use of amusement devices to persons employed at or attending amusement parks, and in the event of a personal injury, to ensure that the injured party has the possibility of financial recovery. It is the intent of this chapter that amusement devices must be designed, constructed, assembled, or disassembled, maintained, and operated so as to prevent injuries. Now, contrast that statement of purpose against this public duty statement in the building code. It's quite stark, and the court relied on that very strong statement of purpose to find that the legislature intended that this statute do something more than impose a public duty on the inspectors at LOR. Consequently, Steinke was able to pursue its claim against South Carolina LLR, and I can't remember what the outcome was, whether it was settled or a verdict was entered. I do recall that there was a $12 million award against the operators of the bungee jumping apparatus. But again, the important analysis here is that these duties that are imposed by the building code and by the legislature in mandating that building codes be adopted and enforced. In fact, we don't even adopt building codes anymore. They're pronounced upon us by the legislature or by the Codes Council in Columbia. I used to call them the Code Czar because they like to change things. So I would call when I was city attorney in Columbia, I'd get a little frustrated. You know, they produce them to change things. They'd call us and say, you've got to adopt this version and these discrete changes that we've cooked up here in Columbia. And I used to call my lawyer friend at LLR, and I'd ask him, what did the Code Czar have to say about this particular matter? So with respect to building codes, and I think business licensing, it's a public duty. John's given us a taste of a recent court order out of, was it Bonneville, yeah, in the circuit court, where one of our circuit judges has ruled that this is a public duty area. So no duty arises to the plaintiff, to the individual, and consequently, the case goes away for lack of that underlying duty. Let's see, a couple of comments. And, you know, I do come from a municipal background, but Gary can tell you, I'm not diving wool municipalian. I think there's some misbehaving municipalians sometimes, and we need to deal with that. But the city is not an insurer of the purchasers of homes or structures. This isn't a program that's designed to afford folks some protection. Folks need to get their own inspection done and have somebody there, if necessary, 24/7 to observe the conduct of the contractors and the subcontractors. The building code is not about aesthetics or workmanship. It's about life safety, as is stated in the code and as John has informed you. Scott's comments relative to licensing. It's a revenue move, one of the few that the legislature continues to authorize to us. It's used, at least in Columbia, was used as a, and I think virtually everywhere else, as a checkoff device. So when a new business shows up at the business license office, they're given a clearance sheet, and they've got to go around and be sure that the physical location that they wish to locate at is properly zoned. I know in Columbia it would trigger a fire inspection. All of those things designed to assure compliance with other municipal code and life safety kinds of considerations, but has nothing to do with consumer protection. All those are matters that are entirely outside of the purview of a business license program. Now, where you can get into trouble is in failing to license legal and lawful businesses. Lawful businesses are entitled to be licensed as long as they can get the right checkoffs and make their application properly. You can get in trouble, in my experience, in meddling with that license once it's issued by virtue of trying to suspend it or revoke it, unless you go through a due process type of hearing procedure and make sure you've got your I's dotted and your T's crossed. You'd be very careful about revoking or otherwise meddling with lawfully permitted businesses. I know there's this temptation of we've got a nuisance going on over here, and let's just summarily revoke or suspend the operation of the license. I caution you against that, and I know you've got a good city attorney here, and I'm sure he's going to protect you from those kind of inclinations. I know that's a mouthful and a lot of perhaps legalese. I try not to get too bogged down in the legalities. Let me give my piece of paper here a quick check. I'll be happy to answer any general questions that you might have about municipal liability.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. That concludes the initial presentation, and we now open it up to questions from council members.
Absolutely. Let me ask one quick question. What time do our speakers have to leave? I think it was discussed at first, but just to make sure everybody knows.
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Mr. Mayor, let me just be very straightforward with this issue. We were concerned that about the obligation of a building inspector for a new house and any indemnification or liability that fell to the city by virtue of the building inspector's performance. So what I heard you say, I think, is that that does not warranty any of the workmanship on the house. That's an issue between the owner-occupant or the builder and the tradespeople that that performed or built the house.
That's correct.
Okay. And with regard to the licensing, we license a developer. What do we do for the subcontractors? Do we have any responsibility for validating licensing of subcontractors of a house?
Mr. Dwyer, in the model ordinance, and it's also in the city's ordinance, that you do ask for and require that they show evidence of their qualifications. And typically that's going to be assurances that they are licensed by LLR, that they carry the proper credentials. And so that's for contractors, subcontractors, anybody who is going to, particularly somebody who's going to require an inspection of their work. The model ordinance and your ordinance as well require that they show those credentials.
So would it be fair to assume, going down the line, didn't intend to do that, would it be fair to assume that a standard building permit is probably going to have 10 or 12 certifications of...
The problem you have there is when, like, especially with residential, you have the builder's got a license with LLR.
Sure.
The mechanical, plumbing, electrical have a license with LLR. And then they have a specialty license, which is basically, in my opinion, a joke, because you can go get one for $50. You don't have to have no qualification or nothing else. And so, you know, and even though you might have one for like concrete work or something like that, I mean, it's you know, it's, there's no, I mean, that's been some of the municipal associations fought for years and all that, and, but besides them four, there's really no other license in the state.
But you're asking whether they have should have a business license. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, well,
yes.
Well, I mean, yeah, make sure you understand the distinction between the city-issued business license and the license that John is talking about. That's a license to be an electrician anywhere in the state.
In the state.
And the city business license requires for contractors that they show the city evidence that they are a licensed electrician that can do business as that electrician in the state.
So, but if the electrician, we'll use that as an example, as a subcontractor mm-hmm. for a builder, mm-hmm. the builder has a business license. Now, is the electrician have to have a business license, or does he operate under the authority
yes.
of the builder?
Yes, and again, that is the determination of whether or not the subcontractor should also have a city-issued business license is a policy decision for the council.
We do require it.
There are some, yeah.
We do require it.
But some cities do not.
Okay.
Require a business license, a city business license of subcontractors.
Okay.
Now we have a person on patrol of construction sites every single day.
Yeah.
Chasing that down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mayor, I want to thank you, Mr. Mayor, and John, our city manager, for bringing John England and Scott Slayton. And James Meigs here, and you come highly credentialed with your, not only with your background, but your level of experience, and to bring clarity to a great deal of discussion that's been taking place in this city, whether it deals with inspection of homes, but other things as well. And John, I would like to continue this as long as you're here. When we have these discussions taking place, that you bring these kinds of experts to the table, because we have been all over the map with speculations of what we think should happen, and no one really knows until you hear from these people that have been in the business for a while. Having said that, there are several things that I have to ask, and I think you made, Scott, the comment, maybe it was you, John, under the only municipal general fund revenue source that is locally controlled by the city, Scott, you said that.
Yes.
And you used the quote for now.
Yes.
Tell me why you said for now.
Well, Councilman Price, there have been many attacks on business licensing in the General Assembly over the years.
Mm-hmm.
It is an unpopular tax that you levy. And
a mandate that we don't want.
I'm sorry?
And a mandate that we don't want to have to pay for. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Right. And so, like most taxes, people don't want to pay them. And,
right.
And I understand that. But a bill was filed earlier this year in the session, House Bill 3490. It was filed by Representative Rick Quinn that would do several things. First, it would cap the maximum amount of a business license tax that you could impose at $100, despite the fact that 80% of business licenses that are paid across the state are less than $100, but you could not collect more than $100 from any business. That includes the mom and pop shop here on Main Street or Walmart out on the highway. It would require the South Carolina Department of Revenue to collect your business license tax on your behalf and then submit it back to you. Well, we know how that's worked out mm-hmm. with other state collected revenues over the years. Those are probably two of the most egregious components of the bill. We have been working with Representative Quinn on his bill for a number of months with a group, the Home Builders Association, the State Chamber of Commerce, and other stakeholders in this issue. But make no mistake, whether Representative Quinn's bill moves forward or not, some other proposal is going to come along. And so that's why anybody at the Municipal Association will tell you that, particularly when it comes to business license tax and the attacks that it faces yearly, it's the only one that you control completely for now.
Correct. Okay. The other comment you made, Scott, dealt with vetting. Some want to use the tax for additional vetting. And the question that I have is, if they use this tax for additional vetting, what does that do on business itself? Does it limit the number of businesses that can enter competition?
Well, to the extent that it puts additional burdens on the business to meet whatever requirements you as a city choose to put on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, right now your ordinance requires that they just simply show evidence that they are credentialed, that they have this qualification from an LLR. Your ordinance, I don't think, and I'll leave it to your staff, but I don't think the model ordinance anyway does not require the business to produce any other evidence of something that it should or should not be.
Okay.
The more things more hoops you add to the business to jump through, then it costs the business more money, it takes them more time to get up and running, and in the private business world, the last thing you need are more obstacles to them.
They already feel overwhelmed as it stands now. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Meggs, Mr. Mayor, if I may. You had mentioned that the building code really is designed to meet a public duty, not create an individual duty, and through that there's essentially some immunity. I recognize from your bio that you've done a lot of work in the arena of zoning. Do you feel that the zoning codes or zoning ordinances would meet that same type of immunity or standard that they are established for a public duty or a public good, and they wouldn't lend themselves to individual liabilities from an individual towards a city or an employee?
That's my belief, yes.
What other than the building code and the zoning code, do you know of any others through your municipal work that you would say fall in that same category?
Well, that's a
tough question.
Question. I think virtually anything in your code, the standard codes, with some exception, I was involved in a case as an expert witness in Orangeburg, city of Orangeburg, several years ago. The plaintiff in that case had a building that was in the eyes of the building inspector substandard to the point that it needed to be demolished. And in fact, the city came in and demolished it. The court, this is a case that went up to the Court of Appeals, so you can read all about it. It's called a case called Chakbarti, Chakbarti. And the court found liability in that case, but did so, I think, on two bases that are not totally apparent in the opinion, and you had to know a little bit more about the history of the Chakbartis and their relationship with the city officials. This is a wonderful, as y'all like to say, segue into a war story that will give you a little more insight. I'd be curious to see if John has a comment about this. And in my experience, I was with the city of Columbia for 25 years and dealt with the building and fire officials regularly. The folks tend to want to work with people, with property owners,
mm-hmm.
to the point of, and it's just a desire to try to get along and work people through a problem that they're having with a building. That's what went on in Orangeburg, and I observed that in 25 years with Columbia. You don't want to tear people's houses down. That's not the purpose of the exercise. What you want to do is have it be properly renovated and brought back to standard, occupied, get back on the tax rolls, the whole the whole drill. Well, unfortunately, in the course of trying to work with the property owners, the building official would issue a building permit, and it might have an expiry of a year or 6 months. But something would happen in the meantime to get things stirred back up. Maybe there'd be a fire, or there'd be an inspection, and they'd find that no work was ongoing. And so I think there was enough evidence there of, I would say, working with. Others would say just jerking on out. And so between those kind of bad facts, even though viewed from a different perspective, they were not bad facts. The jury didn't like those facts. And the court found that in the International Property Maintenance Code, which was what Orangeburg was operating under, there were some specific notices and some specific steps that had to be given to the property owner before enforcement action could be taken. And it was as a consequence of those specific steps, just like this statute we read about, the purpose of the inspection of the bungee jumping thing. There are some parallels that I think you can draw between what this IM, the IPMC, I get the things mixed up. There are some parallels that you can draw between the, you know, the requirements in that code for notice and steps that have to be taken to a discrete property owner, not to the public generally, and not for the purpose of assuring life safety or the health and welfare of our first responders, which is what your building code's about.
I follow you.
Because of those specific things.
Right, I follow you. There's individual duties that might be within the context of the entire system.
There was no public duty. It got deeper than public duty.
Right, it went down to that individual level. But let me maybe ask my question in a more specific manner. When you look at, you know, the city can set certain traffic laws, codes, whatever you want to call it, and naturally, you know, people are involved every day in accidents where they run a red light or a stop sign or they're speeding or whatever, and we didn't catch them first, and we aren't then as a city held liable because we weren't necessarily enforcing our speed limit or enforcing our stop sign that well. And so what I had in mind is, you know, if we have certain standards or laws or ordinances that are for the good, and use traffic laws as an example, and I'll even get more specific. You know, if we have an area that previously we looked at a road where we wanted to put a bicycle path on it, and that was going to create a situation where we wouldn't allow, if parking were allowed, it would be in the bicycle path, and you'd have a case where you'd have interference between the cars parked and bicycles and whatnot. And we were basically told that that we couldn't do that because allowing bicycles to, or allowing cars to park in a bicycle lane would violate our own code, our own ordinance, and could open us up to liability if somebody were hurt. And so I guess what I'm trying to ask, I'm doing a pretty poor job of it, but if the basic ordinances themselves were established for the public good,
sure,
but they weren't necessarily enforced in every case, whether it be running a stop sign or whether it be a car parking in a bicycle lane, would any of those open the city up to individual liability because we didn't enforce our standards 100% of the time in 100% of the cases?
Well, two thoughts. First, when you say individual liability, you mean liability to an injured party, not individual liability for any city official.
Would the city itself be liable to that plaintiff, that injured party?
Well, I always like to think that we apply and enforce standards uniformly across the board.
But you can't catch every speeder or every illegally parked car or anything.
And I think because of the way the legislature has carved out various reservations of immunity in this Tort Claims Act, it would be very difficult to make just a generalized statement about, sure, it's all protected. So I'm not able to do that for you. And that kind of begs the question, first you've got to answer, what is the nature of the duty? Because, and I'm sure I didn't make this clear in my presentation, the public duty rule is not immunity. It just is it's a negative. It's, if there's no duty, there can be no negligence claim. Okay. So, again, that begs that public duty question, and I think you'd have to analyze each situation against this rubric of, you know, what's the purpose of the exercise? Is the purpose life safety? Is it public health?
You determine if it was a public duty or if it had a more individual scope.
But if your code on one hand says you can't put parking in a bike lane or whatever the regulation is, but we go ahead and violate it, I can't say that you're in good shape doing that. There are some cases that stand
that's
for proposition.
That's kind of what we've been told before. I just was hearing something that needed to dig into a little bit.
I have another question, please. The city has a specification on how a driveway should be built, or a sidewalk, or a road, or even for that matter, a house, or any part of a house.
Sure.
And the specifications in the city ordinance. Who's ultimately responsible to making sure that that specification is complied with, and what role does a building inspector have in that process?
Well, the responsibility for compliance is with the person that constructs the works, and that can be, and then ultimately the general contractor, and no one else. The city's role is to basically do kind of sampling, if you will, since you're not out there 24/7 or even every day. The city's role is to do the best it can do to assure compliance with the minimal life safety requirements in the code, because that's the foundation and the gist of why the code exists, is for life safety and the protection of the firefighters and the other first responders. I don't even know that a driveway is subject to inspection under the...
I'm just a sociology major.
It's not.
The other issue is clear for licensing, plumbers, electricians, and so forth. People building roads, I mean, is that a skill that is licensed, or is it just generally assumed that if you know how to build a house, you know how to build a road?
That's more of a DOT problem.
I mean, you know, we even sometimes run into places. And it was kind of an example, one of the jurisdictions had a bridge going in, and you know, which is kind of well out of my frame of thought, but it was on private property, so you know, and I mean, that's not in our books, and that had nothing to do with us at all, and so, I mean, at that point, you start calling on DOT and some other people like that to have expertise on that, and maybe even, you know, and this has happened, like with the bridge incident, the building official has the authority to go say, okay, well, are you building a bridge on your property? I don't know what it's going to be. So I want you to go find me an outside source that knows more about bridges than I do. And, you know, we've even, over the last, about 6 years ago, LLR come up and not only licensed us as inspectors for, I call it Chapter 1 of the code, which is what we do. They started licensing the soil people and the concrete people and the concrete testing people and all these other people, and which are specialty in their trades, and all we do is monitor what they do. And, you know, like I tell building inspectors, you know, you got to know enough about that business to be dangerous. I don't have to know how to do the testing, but I have to know what questions to ask and stuff like that. I mean, because you got to understand, residential is one thing, but when you start getting to commercial, you're getting a whole other ball game there. So, I mean, you know, so LRR, and I'll be honest with you, it's kind of interesting. I go to a lot of states, and you think there's building inspectors everywhere. They're not. It's kind of funny. The state of Alabama passed the statewide energy code, and all builders have to comply with the energy code. Well, guess what? There's no inspectors. There's like 300 inspectors in the whole state of Alabama. So, I mean, and they're only in the cities. I mean, so there's no county inspectors or whatever. Half the counties in Georgia don't have building inspectors today. So, I mean, as far as South Carolina, kind of where we fit in this whole scheme of things, I think countrywide, I mean, the city manager alluded that I'm a master code professional, and there's 800 of them nationwide. South Carolina has 80 of them. And we have 10% of them in the country. You know, Florida's got 80, but they've got like five times the inspectors we have. You know what I mean? So, I mean, so which is kind of good in a way. I mean, we're way above a lot of other jurisdictions, I think. You know what I mean? So, I mean, California don't even license building inspectors as far as advanced they are. So, but you rely on other people a lot of times. Engineers, we always have that thing, we can go always ask for other expertise. And, I mean, the building officials, and I see this happen time and time again with councils and stuff like that, it's kind of like the more education we get, the better off we are. And like going to building official conferences and places like that, it's not just about sitting in a classroom sometimes, but about getting to know another building official somewhere like the City of Columbia. I pick up the phone and call him and say, listen, what are you doing in the City of Columbia? You know, and building officials is a tight-knit little, I mean, there's 800 of us in this country, in this state, and we all talk.
I have several questions. I didn't hear much about consumer protectionism other than life saving. All I hear is the court system. I think there's one thing, and it just is a question. 1986, there's also came about the LLC, limited liability contractor, is my understanding, which is used greatly in all trades nowadays, industry as well as that. The other thing is, was it not in the, maybe it was early 90s, but I think it was around the late 1980s, the TURC liability for builders, isn't there a minimum amount you can sue for that you have, like $13,600 or something? And I remember that because there's a certain threshold down in there that a contractor is protected. I went through that on my particular house, and that's what was thrown up to me by a local attorney here that does that. The other part that I want to be sure to understand, when you were talking about business licenses issued, if the city, does the city have to be sure that the contractors are registered with LLR?
If the ordinance requires it. The model ordinance requires that, as I said earlier, that the contractor show evidence of qualifications. And typically those qualifications include licensure from LLR. Does not require evidence that the business is allowed to do anything else or has been registered with any other state agency. The model ordinance's requirement is strictly for evidence of qualifications from LLR. Now, if a city council wants to add a definition of what those qualifications are and what that should also include, then it's free to do so. But the model ordinance does not do that. For instance, there's no requirement in the model ordinance that the license being issued is dependent on whether or not a business is registered as a business in the state or any other state for that matter. It is a requirement. It only requires that they show that they have licensure from LLR.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The person is licensed with LLR, not the company.
Right.
That the person, not the corporation. So, I mean, like me, I own like four different companies. So if I wanted to start four different contracting companies and call them four different contracting companies, and my license was under each one of these companies, I could do it tomorrow. Now, if you bring charges against me, against LLR, you're going to bring it against my license personally, not against the company.
Right.
So, I mean, so I think that's where a little bit of confusion sometimes comes up
Yeah, John England, the individual who is the contractor doing the work, is the one who is licensed, not John England LLC.
Yeah.
So it's the individual that carries right. the license and not the shell company, so to speak, because we're in the age of shell companies.
Yeah.
And that, and part of our problem in this particular neighborhood, there's a number of several companies, but it's the same name signing on all the bottom of the companies.
I guess that, that's... I had a comment to this question. I think the requirement to show credentialing really originated in the technical trades, gas, plumbing, electrical, etc. So that the building official ultimately knows that this is not a jackleg electrician. This is someone who's got the knowledge and skill and the credential from the state. All of that serves the purpose of the code, and that is life safety, because the jackleg's going to wire it wrong and we're going to have a house fire. That's going to endanger the police, that's going to endanger the ambulance folks, that's going to endanger the firefighters, and the residents of the and owners of the property. But all of that credentialing requirement, I think, was originally intended to enhance and advance the purpose of the building code.
The other thing you've mentioned about revoking the business license, then my question is, how would you keep these same contractors out of town that you know are doing shoddy work, and we have evidence of that, so they can come back to town under the same name and you can't keep them out? I mean, what do you do in
that,
the kitchen? I mean, that's just real life.
Well,
that's how.
Edmund, what I would tell you is that, as Mr. Maggs mentioned earlier, if that business has a legitimate right and has the qualifications to be issued a business license, then the city cannot deny him that business license. It is the consumer's responsibility, be it the last client or the next client, to do his or her due diligence to determine how well that contractor or any other businesses for that matter, how well they do. A business here on Main Street isn't going to stay in business long if they don't treat the customers right and give them a good product. The city is obligated to issue that retail business a business license whether they do a good job or not. So the business license, issuing of a business license is not the city's endorsement of that particular company. It is simply a revenue-generating mechanism.
Next question. You talked about duty owed and breach of duty. In my particular profession, I'm a registered professional engineer, and one of the rules of the road and the quickest way you can get your license pulled, when you know there's a mistake and you don't correct it. You know, I make mistakes in what I'm doing. And there's people that I have hired through the company I work for that look over my shoulder, so to speak. In my professional opinion, we have some issues with infrastructure and with other issues in the city that people in charge of that knew it was wrong. And I can get into the detail of infrastructure and so forth. And it gets into SCDOT and ASME and ASTM and the civil engineering standards. But once you know something is wrong and you perpetuate that, to me, that's a breach of duty. And that's where I'm headed with some of the things with the city now. And part of it's on my road. You mentioned about the wooden bridges in the city. I'm part of that because the time frame you mentioned is about where I tangled with SCDOT on three roads that I think, three bridges that I think are illegally built in the city. And so, I guess my question is, where does that come up in the, if you will, the duty on, breach of duty in the city when somebody knows it's wrong? And they are a professional engineer or something, and they continue to do it. Where does that fall in line that, hey, at some point, you know, they represent the city, and they represent 30,000 people in Aiken. And I guess that's my question. At what point is that considered breach of duty? Is it 1 year? Is it 5 years or 10 years?
This engineer is a city official, a city employee. Well, I suspect that if your theory is correct, that he or she will end your career with the city of Aiken.
But how do we get stuff fixed that over the years this has caused a problem of? And this same neighborhood with the houses has the same problem with the road, and this is perpetuated.
Well, I assume that your city code requires that neighborhoods or subdivisions be developed with either roads that will be built to certain standards and dedicated to the city, or perhaps you allow private roads to be constructed up to certain specifications and maintained in perpetuity by Property Owners Association.
Yes. The standards are the SCDO standards that we use here in the city and the county.
Sure.
I use them in the industry I'm working on. And so, I mean, it's well adapted standards.
All right. And those standards, just like the building code standards, are designed to advance life safety and protection of the general public welfare, not the individual property owner. So from the city of Aiken's liability perspective, I don't see that the city could be on the hook. Now, could this, I don't want to get too specific, but I again would expect that that kind of misbehavior, if it does in fact exist, would be met with a termination.
But if it went on for a number of years, then you would suspect there'd be some breach of duty to the public.
Well, public duty, sure.
Okay. Which gives no and I'm asking those questions for a reason, because that's, you know, I'm on that side of the fence.
I understand.
I have been to LLR and talked to them, not only on the city issues, but some, unfortunately, I have to deal with them through Cherokee County and Spartanburg County and Greenville County. And, you know, I found them to be very upright and straightforward on that. One of the things that they told me, and this was an older employee that had been up and down the road, that quality never goes away when there's in a particular public inspection type thing. For instance, if a house problem shows up 3 or 4 years later, the consumer still has the right to go back to the contractor that did the poor quality. And that would be true in the houses that we're talking about here now, I would assume.
Let me just say, Mr. Metz, I noticed you're taking some notes. There's a bit more to this whole issue. And who owns the roads, whether the city owns the road, how much involvement did we have in the very beginning, how much involvement we have now in order to come to a solid analysis. And I noticed that you're hedging a bit, and you're hedging in the correct way, not knowing the full story of what's required here. That's your legal background to do that. But certainly this is something that the city council has been quite concerned about because of the residents. We know a lot of the people that live in that area, and we took some ownership, personal ownership, given the fact that they were living in an area that was a newly developed area, patched roads, and a lot of disgruntled people out there based on the climate right now. And so that would be, if you're going to comment, I would ask you to investigate that a bit more before making.
Well, I think my assignment was to engage in a general discussion. And after dealing with clients and folks for more years than I care to count now, I realize that when you get into a specific situation,
yes,
generally you get the facts one fact at a time.
Yes.
And as they accumulate, your views can change. So I think I'll...
Well, there's a chain of custody here, in my opinion, and also in the breach of duty as well as duty to the public. And there's a chain of custody that goes down this. And as I mentioned, when when you know there's a problem, you're supposed to work to fix it and not let it go on for years and years. And that's the position that I'm taking, and I've discussed it with LLR as the Attorney General. And it's a time frame period that it also works into this, as you well know.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think let me ask a question. We've talked a lot about public duty rule. What is a good definition of that? I don't want to come in the discussion, and I'd just like to get a better feel, and just myself here,
okay,
of what the definition would be of that.
Let me see if I can find you a cite out of a case. If you'll, maybe we can take another question while I...
Sure.
I dig that out for you.
I'll make one quick comment. I think what you're telling us is no part of this precludes anybody from having a grievance or even trying to file a suit. What you're telling us, though, is that that there's a standard by which that suit might ultimately be heard or judged. And this isn't the courtroom. You aren't here to judge the right or wrong of our particular case, and so there's no need to get into the specifics of it. But that... if and when a case might be made and we do find ourselves in a court, it would be the question of public duty that might determine whether the city has any liability with respect to the roads or any houses or anything else that are in question. I think that's what you're telling us in general terms. So, I mean, today's not the place to adjudicate it. You're saying that that's the standard.
That's correct.
Right.
I think when you said we have any public questions, we have a few minutes left.
Yeah, well, let's give James
he's
another
minute.
Why don't you take another question, and I'll go.
We'll try to ask somebody else a question so you can read.
In this meantime, it's getting close to 6, very close. Does anyone want to speak, would like to speak?
Stuart.
I'm sorry. What?
Just invite him up so that Sarah can get up.
Yeah, if anyone would like to speak, just come up and give us your name.
I'll be happy to give you a little reading from the Stanky case.
Okay.
Many statutes impose a duty on public officials to perform certain acts. Generally, however, such officials enjoy immunity from a private cause of action under the public duty rule. This rule holds that public officials are generally not liable to individuals for their negligence in discharging public duties, as the duty is owed to the public at large rather than anyone individually. The public duty rule is distinguishable from a defense of immunity, which is an affirmative defense that must be pled and can be waived. In contrast, the public duty rule is a defense that denies an element of the plaintiff's cause of action, the existence of a duty of care to the individual plaintiff. And then the court goes on to say you have to analyze the statutory bases and other things that can give rise to a way around the public duty rule, including something called the special relationship, which is a 6-factor test. I'm not going to bore you with that. One of the most recent treatments of that of this rule and the special relationship test comes out of a case out of Aiken County. It was a case involving the Sheriff's Department. It's a published case, and I'll be happy to provide Gary the citation, and y'all can take a look at it.
You'll send that to him. You don't remember the name of the case?
The Aiken case?
Right.
I've got it right here. My photographic memory was lost about 10 years ago.
It's not digital photographs.
I want to say something with an A. Let's see what it says. Arthur's versus Aiken County.
Oh, yeah.
And the site is, it's a 2001 Supreme Court of South Carolina case. Site is 346 South Carolina 97, 551 Southeast 2nd, 579. It's a very unfortunate case about the sheriff's duty to control some injuries that perhaps death in a criminal domestic violence.
Let me say it's about six now. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us. This has been a wonderful experience and learning a lot. And I know it's taking your time and efforts to do this for us, and we really appreciate it. And I feel sure that it's going to be extremely helpful for us as we move forward on some of the issues that we have. And so, again, thank you, sir.
I want to also say just again thank you to Mayor Kavanaugh and to John Clem. This is an example of one of a lot of different areas that we can learn a whole lot. And this kind of thing is tremendously helpful because all of us are experts at something, but none of us are experts at everything. And so I want to just thank y'all for setting this up and taking the time. Thank you guys for coming.
I would agree. Thank you.
We are adjourned.
Snacks.
When you see, we can get hard copy minutes of this meeting.
I asked you that remarkably vague and awkward question.
Thank you.
Get the man that's so well.